After a somewhat gradual start, clinical research in biologic-targeted therapy of lung cancer is now progressing at a rapid pace. I asked Dr. Ronald Natale to review some of the new agents being evaluated, and he began by commenting on an interesting new compound with two apparent mechanisms of action.
ZD-6474, or Zactima, is one of a growing list of multi-targeted kinase inhibitors. This is an oral agent that targets VEGF receptor 2 and 3, targets the tyrosine kinases, ranks among one of the most potent inhibitors of the VEGFR 2 and 3 kinases, and also targets EGFR. It's a moderately potent inhibitor of the EGF receptor tyrosine kinase. Now, as is the case with a number of the novel agents that target the VEGFR receptor kinases, it also hits RET kinase, which is overexpressed in medullary cilia of the thyroid and other MEN1 and 2 tumors. And in fact, it may be approved by the Food and Drug Administration sometime within the next year for the treatment of those cancers. Clinical trials are in progress with ZD-6474 and others. Our goal and our objective was to evaluate the effectiveness of ZD-6474 in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. In the phase 1 trial, at least in one of the phase 1 trials that was conducted, there were some responses observed in Japanese patients. Now, we know, of course, that Japanese patients, especially the non-smoking patients, have a remarkable sensitivity to EGFR inhibitors. And ZD-6474 is an EGFR inhibitor, as well as a VEGFR-targeted agent. So the question that we posed is, if it is active in lung cancer, is it active because of its EGFR-targeted properties or because of its VEGFR-targeted properties? So to answer that question, we designed a randomized, blinded study to compare it head-to-head with gefitinib, Iressa, which was commercially available and approved at the time of the study design. Patients with non-small cell lung cancer who had received one or a few patients, two prior chemotherapy regimens, were eligible for this randomization between Iressa and ZD-6474. They received agents orally and were evaluated at four-week intervals with follow-up CT scans. If there was evidence of disease progression, treatment was stopped. We allowed a four-week period for washout because both drugs have a long half-life, and then treatment was alternated while we maintained the blind. So patients who were first treated with gefitinib, Iressa, if their cancers progressed, were alternated to ZD-6474 and vice versa. Patients treated with ZD-6474 first were then alternated to Iressa.
Can you talk a little bit about what has been seen previously in other studies of 6474, and particularly the issue about the dose and how the dose affected sort of the mechanism?
Yeah. Well, in the phase 1 trial, they explored doses up to 600 milligrams a day. At 600 milligrams per day, they really observed dose-limiting toxicities that included typical EGFR-type toxicities with skin rash, with diarrhea, although we now know that diarrhea is more due to quinazolines in the GI tract rather than any direct EGFR inhibition on GI mucosa, some mild nausea, and it also had some VEGFR inhibitory properties or toxicities that we see with other anti-angiogenic agents, such as headaches, dizziness, some patients with grade 3 hypertension. And finally, as is often the case with some quinazolines, there were patients who had QT interval prolongations on their electrocardiograms. So at 600 milligrams per day, that incidence of QT interval prolongation was probably unacceptably high. The maximum dose that we thought was reasonable for phase 2 trial was the 300 milligram per day dose, and that's the dose that we used in this study. So in this randomized trial, it was a randomization between 250 milligrams per day of gefitinib, Iressa, the standard approved dose at the time, and 300 milligrams per day, what we believe to be the maximum easily tolerable dose of ZD-6474, in which few patients would require a dose interruption or a dose attenuation because of severe toxicity or QT interval problems.
Have objective responses been seen to the agent prior to that?
Well, again, the only studies done prior to that were in the phase one trial, and there were objective responses seen in 4 out of 9 lung cancer patients in Japan.
Can you talk about the results of the findings that you presented at ASCO?
So in this clinical trial, if you look at the objective response rate, it was 8% with ZD6474 and a stable disease rate of around 35%. So a little better than a 40% overall benefit rate.
Stable for how long?
Stable for a 4-week confirmation of the stable, so 8 weeks or longer.
And how many patients were enrolled?
There were over 80 patients in each arm. So if we had done just a phase two trial, those results would have been, I think, of modest interest. This study is a good example of where a randomized phase two trial design is very valuable because we have a control arm. And what we didn't know is that for whatever reason, this population of patients as a whole were fairly refractory to an EGFR-targeted agent. And the 80-plus patients that were randomized to gefitinib, there was only one objective responder and a stable disease rate, I think, again, of around 30%. So overall, the clinical benefit rate with Iressa is much less than we've seen in prior trials with Iressa. For example, the IDEAL-2 trial or the ISIL trial that was conducted where it was randomized versus placebo, where the objective response rate was around 8.5%.
What was the smoking status and other factors in the two groups?
The groups were well balanced with respect to age and proportion of men and women, proportion of patients with adenocarcinoma versus non-adenos. So this trial was open to patients with non-adenocarcinomas. And I believe the smoking distribution was what you'd expect in the second line setting, with around 15 to 18% or so of patients who were never smokers.
In both groups?
In both groups, yeah.
That's a little bit higher than you maybe. You think that's what it is in an average population?
Well, once you, not in the first line setting, but once you get to the second line setting, you do enrich the population of never smokers because never smokers, first of all, have a slower growing form of lung cancer. They often will respond to first line treatment or at least have disease stabilization. So more never smokers make it to the second line setting than smokers do with lung cancer. For example, if you look at the BR21 trial conducted by the NCI Canada of erlotinib, Tarceva versus placebo, 21.5% of those patients were never smokers.
Were you surprised there weren't more responses in the gefitinib arm, considering there were 10 or 15% non-smokers?
Oh, I was. You know, there were 85 patients with about an 8 to 10% response rate. We would have expected 7 or 8 responders, and we only had one objective responder. So as I said, I think this is an example of one of the values of having a control arm in the early development of some of these novel targeted agents, especially if you have an agent like ZD6474 that has both EGFR and VEGFR-targeted properties. We had a higher response rate to ZD6474, but the primary endpoint of the study was progression-free survival. We were looking for a progression-free survival that favored ZD6474 that was better than Iressa. The Iressa progression-free survival outcome was exactly the same as it's been seen in other studies, with a little over a 2-month median, and the progression-free survival with ZD6474 was statistically significantly better. Something of around 11 weeks or so. So 11 and a half weeks. So about 3 months versus 2 months. About a 45% improvement in progression-free survival comparing ZD6474 to gefitinib, Iressa. So that was the signal we were looking for to tell us whether or not it would be worthwhile pursuing additional, more costly, and larger, more definitive clinical trials. The crossover or the switchover part of the study was also important. There were, I think, over 35 patients in the Iressa arm that made the crossover to ZD6474 and about 30 patients in the ZD6474 arm that made the crossover to Iressa. Crossing over from Iressa to ZD6474, we had a disease control rate, when you look at confirmed stabilization for 8 weeks or longer, of somewhere in the neighborhood of around 35 to 40%, which is pretty good considering all of these patients had disease progression on Iressa. We would interpret that as meaning that these patients clearly did not have tumors that were sensitive to EGFR inhibition, And so that disease stabilization, we believe, points to ZD6474's VEGFR-targeted properties.
What about responses?
No objective responses.
I don't know, you know, some of these things like 3 versus 2 months or, you know, there's very small numbers. Sort of taking a step back, kind of look at it clinically as opposed to statistically, it sounds a little bit not too impressive. Yeah.
Well, remember, the purpose of these randomized phase 2 trials are not to establish the clinical utility of these drugs. It's to get a signal that indicates, should we go on with the larger, more expensive phase 3 trials?
Could you talk a little bit more about the difference between a randomized phase 2 and a randomized phase 3 in terms of the, you know, sort of how to interpret it and what the intent is?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of controversy about randomized phase 2 trials. Statisticians and many will tell you that these are underpowered studies, that they in fact are so underpowered because they're small populations. Here's a clinical trial with a total of about 165 patients total randomized to 2 arms. And they'll tell you that they're so underpowered that you're as likely to get a negative signal as you are a positive signal. On the other hand, those of us who have been doing clinical trials for some time, despite that relatively valid statistical criticism, we've come to appreciate that these randomized phase 2 trials do in fact give you an important lead as to what questions to ask next and whether or not a definitive randomized phase 3 trial that's powered to look at a statistically significant difference in survival outcome is worth the investment. You know, there are so many novel biological agents that are being developed now that pharmaceutical companies are in the situation of having to measure how much investment do we put into the development of these drugs? Is there some way to get a signal early on? Especially since many of these drugs are competing for limited resources with other drugs that are in their pipeline. It's particularly true with anti-angiogenic drugs. Our lead agent, bevacizumab, the monoclonal antibody that binds the ligand, VEGF, in 19 patients with non-small cell lung cancer in a phase 2 trial, there were no objective responders. So we've learned that we cannot use objective response, a radiographic response, as the be-all and end-all endpoint for simple screening of a lot of these novel agents.
Do you think that the conduct of these trials is precise enough that you can really tell the difference between, you know, 12 weeks and 8 weeks in terms of progression?
Well, remember, that's the median point. What we do look at, obviously, is the entire survival curve. And the Kaplan-Meier plots do take into account the entire progression-free survival. The progression-free survival curve with ZD6474 departs early from the progression-free survival of gefitinib and remains separate throughout its entire duration. We may pick a certain point for descriptive purposes, such as the median progression-free survival, and note that it is a month longer with ZD6474 than it is with Iressa. I agree with you completely. This is a small difference, relatively speaking. But again, the purpose of this trial was to get a signal.
What about the other crossover going to gefitinib?
The other crossover, when we switched from ZD6474 to gefitinib, Iressa, you know, keep in mind, we would have expected that if ZD6474 had no significant EGFR inhibitory properties, that Iressa should produce a 40-45% disease stabilization rate. Instead, the disease stabilization rate was only 23%. So it was half of what you would expect. So that tells us that at the 300 milligram dose, the ZD6474 has at least some, perhaps important, EGFR inhibitory properties. We also know from laboratory studies that inhibiting EGFR not only blocks EGFR-mediated proliferation or EGFR inhibition of apoptosis, it also blocks EGFR-mediated secretion of VEGF.
EGFR-mediated secretion of VEGF?
Yeah. If you look at human lung cancer cells and measure the consequences of EGFR signaling, that EGFR drives proliferation, it blocks apoptosis, it activates genes that are involved in metastasis, but it also activates genes that are responsible for VEGF secretion by the cancer cell to stimulate nearby blood vessels to drive that angiogenic process. So blocking EGFR does result in some anti-angiogenesis by virtue of decreasing VEGF. What ZD6474 does, it blocks both VEGFR tyrosine kinases and, by virtue of its EGFR properties, inhibitory properties, has at least the potential to decrease VEGF secretion by cancer cells.
What do we know about the issue of, you know, different agents and their impact on EGFR, gefitinib, erlotinib, and the EGFR properties in 6474? Are they all roughly the same? Or obviously we come to the conclusion, I guess, that erlotinib is more effective than gefitinib. Molecularly or at a cellular level, what do we see in terms of EGFR inhibition?
I think that erlotinib and gefitinib are probably equally potent EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I think part of the reason that erlotinib was proven to be more clinically useful is that it was dosed much higher. It was dosed very close to its maximum tolerated dose. The maximum tolerated dose in the phase 1 studies with gefitinib were in the range of 800 to 1,000 milligrams a day. So the 250 milligram dose is one-third, maybe one-fourth of the MTD. And probably, in retrospect, was too low of a dose to substantially affect wild-type EGFR to the extent that erlotinib, that Tarceva, does.
And what about 6474? Is there any way to compare the EGFR inhibition there compared to the other agents?
It's hard. I think looking at the IC50s, the concentration that is required for 50% inhibition of the enzyme, of the EGFR tyrosine kinase in a test tube, that the IC50 is higher than the IC50 with either erlotinib or gefitinib. So you would require a much higher oral dose to get equivalent EGFR inhibitory properties. So I think that although ZD6474 has some EGFR inhibition, I think that it's not of the order of magnitude that we see with Tarceva or with Iressa, but it's probably enough at least to affect those cancers that in which EGFR inhibition, to which they're very sensitive to EGFR inhibition, especially the cancers that have certain specific types of mutations, where very high doses of Tarceva, for example, are probably not required to achieve an objective response and a survival improvement, and therefore spare the patient some toxicity. And it may also be enough to impact VEGF secretion by the cancer cell, therefore potentiating ZD6474's anti-angiogenic effects.
What other studies are going on right now in 6474, and where are things heading?
Well, at ASCO, there was another important study presented by Dr. Hamak and his colleagues at MD Anderson for the institutions that participated in a trial combining ZD6474 with docetaxel in the second-line setting. You know, we had concerns because in the past, whenever we've combined an EGFR inhibitor with chemotherapy, we've actually gotten inhibitory effects so that whatever might have been gained by EGFR inhibition was lost because EGFR inhibition, in fact, slowed the proliferation of the cancer and probably rendered it less chemotherapy sensitive.
Sort of like hormones and chemo and breast cancer?
Exactly. So in this randomized phase 2 trial, patients were randomized to receive docetaxel combined with a placebo or combined with either a 100 milligram or a 300 milligram dose of ZD6474.
This was first line?
This is in the second line setting. So with the 100 milligram dose, we're taking advantage probably only of ZD6474's VEGFR inhibitory properties. That dose is probably too low to have any significant EGFR inhibition. The 300 milligram dose, however, was the one that I used in my study, and there is probably at least some EGFR inhibition. Well, interestingly, the results of the study show that the 100 milligram dose was more effective. It had a higher response rate of almost 19%. Compared to about 10 or 11% with docetaxel alone, and it had a statistically significantly better progression-free survival. The 300 milligram dose was intermediate between the 100 milligram dose and the placebo dose in terms of progression-free survival, suggesting perhaps that once you get some EGFR inhibitory properties at that 300 milligram dose, you begin to lose a little bit of what you gained by combining VEGFR inhibitory properties with chemotherapy. The second reason why we believe the 100 milligram dose was better is that it was simply less toxic. When you begin to combine a VEGFR-targeted agent, especially an agent that has skin rash and some mild nausea and some mild hypertension with docetaxel, you begin to get some increase in overall toxicities. You begin to get some increased intolerance, especially with respect to fatigue and asthenia, as we saw in our study and has been seen in some other studies with some of these novel agents.
Have pulmonary hemorrhages been seen with 6474?
It's very interesting. This is the only anti-angiogenic agent in which pulmonary hemorrhages have not been a major problem. In all of our studies, we have not excluded patients with squamous cell cancer. And if you look at the phase 2 trials of sunitinib and sorafenib that were presented at ASCO this past year, those trials appropriately at this first stage of development did not exclude patients with squamous cell cancer, but in both cases, there were deaths from pulmonary hemorrhage in patients with squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. So I think the information that we have with bevacizumab and its risks of producing pulmonary hemorrhage in patients with squamous cell carcinoma has held true for every anti-angiogenic agent tested thus far, with the one exception of ZD6474. So on the safety side, we're quite encouraged by what we've seen so far. If the efficacy information holds up in the more definitive randomized phase 3 trials, which are now in progress, large trials with targeted accruals of over 1,200 patients, combining ZD6474 with docetaxel in the second line setting. There's another trial about to open where it will be combined with pemetrexed or Alimta in the second line setting. And then an international trial that I had, a randomized trial where it's going to be compared head to head with erlotinib. If we can see the kind of results that we saw in these randomized phase 2 trials, we think we'll have an important new agent for lung cancer patients.
Head-to-head with erlotinib in an unselected population?
Unselected population of patients, yes. It's interesting, when we look preclinically in a number of laboratory models, ZD6474 appears to have some effectiveness in cancers in which mutated RAS is overexpressed. Patients with KRAS mutations virtually never respond to EGFR-targeted agents such as erlotinib, Tarceva, or gefitinib, Iressa.
Any guess about why you see, for example, the lack of hemorrhage, why you see responses with KRAS overexpression?
Well, I don't know for sure. There are two possibilities I can think of. One is that it may be possible that when you combine EGFR inhibition with VEGFR inhibition, that since these angiogenic blood vessels, the endothelial cells in these blood vessels, do have EGF receptors, that it is possible that the combined inhibition of those receptors may do something to decrease the risk of pulmonary hemorrhage. The alternative explanation, of course, may be that it is possible that ZD6474 is not an effective anti-angiogenic agent, or that its anti-angiogenic end effects are mediated slightly differently so that pulmonary hemorrhage does not occur.
You mentioned sorafenib and sunitinib. What was seen there in terms of responses?
Well, with sorafenib, there were no objective responses seen using RECIST criteria. With sunitinib, the objective response rate was, I think, about 8.5% or 9%, so comparable to the response rate we saw with ZD6474. But keep in mind, it was an uncontrolled phase 2 trial. But I think the preliminary results were encouraging. On the other hand, the toxicity with sunitinib was a bit discouraging. 38% of patients in that phase 2 trial suffered adverse events that required study withdrawal. There was the expected rates of pulmonary hemorrhage in patients with squamous cell cancer. There were patients that had grade 3 hypertension. There was a relatively high rate of asthenia and fatigue. And there was hematologic toxicity in the form of grade 2, 3, and 4 neutropenia, meaning that this will be a difficult drug perhaps to combine with chemotherapy.
As long as we've got up into the issue of pulmonary hemorrhage, I'm curious what your take or hypothesis is in terms of the etiology of this with bevacizumab.
Well, boy, that's anyone's guess. I think obviously the simple explanation is that this agent has a very powerful and profound effect on the vasculature within tumors, and that at least in the lung parenchyma, because of the very limited stromal support to those blood vessels, that bleeding can occur. I think that this is a major problem with bevacizumab and with all of the anti-angiogenic drugs in lung cancer. It's confined to a very limited small patient population, but unfortunately occurs in patients who are major responders. I had a patient at my institution several months ago who I treated with two cycles of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, who had a dramatic response. This was a patient with adenocarcinoma, no brain metastases, an MRI scan, was not on any anticoagulants for deep venous thromboses or cardiovascular disease.
Where was the lesion?
So was a good candidate. It was a left lower lobe adenocarcinoma. Before we started cycle three, he came in with gross hemoptysis, a tissue box full of bright red blood, and just in the 5 minutes that I saw him, produced half a cup of bright red blood. I took him to the emergency room. He coughed up 2 cups of bright red blood and clearly was about to die. Fortunately, an emergency room physician was available, and we did several things that are important and that I hope to hear confirmation of the usefulness from other individuals around the country. First of all, we put in a double lumen intubation tube. This patient had a left lower lobe tumor. So with one branch of the endotracheal tube with the cuff in that left lower lobe and inflated the cuff in the left mainstem bronchus, what that did is it sealed the left lower lobe of the lung so that any blood would be locked into that left lower lobe. I believe that some of these patients don't die from exsanguination. They die because they drown in their blood. The blood gets into good, healthy lung tissue, and they can't breathe anymore. So this isolated the bleeding source and at least gave us some time. We tried bronchial artery embolization, but could not find a source of the bleeding from that tumor. And then we did something that we had proposed as a technology that could be useful. We did radiofrequency ablation.
Wow.
So we did a transthoracic under CT guidance, passed a probe directly into the tumor. The tip of this probe heats up with radiofrequency waves to about 75, 80 degrees and basically coagulates all of the tissue, all of the blood vessels. It stopped the bleeding instantly in this patient, and we were able to extubate him a few days later without any further bleeding.
Then what happened?
We went on to treat him with carboplatin paclitaxel without bevacizumab. You know, obviously, eventually his disease progressed and he died. But at least it's one anecdotal experience, and I'm hoping that others may have the technology available and are able to turn to it quickly.
That's fascinating. Was he responding?
Oh, he had a dramatic response to the 2 cycles of therapy.
And you knew that before he bled?
Yes.
Was the lesion cavitating?
It was not cavitating.
Getting back to why these bleeds occur, do you think they mainly occur associated with responses?
I believe the bleeds that occur within the first 60 days are primarily associated with major responses.
Is there anything that would trigger you to stop the drug early, like if you started to see cavitation, or is there anything radiologically to look for?
Our database is too small yet for us to be able to make those kinds of decisions. We know that cavitation occurs not infrequently with anti-angiogenic agents combined with chemotherapy, anti-angiogenic agents alone, and even occurs with chemotherapy. So, you know, the process of cavitation is one of the dynamics of responding to therapy. It's not confined solely to anti-angiogenic agents. It may occur more often with anti-angiogenic agents, but it's not confined to those.
Let's flip back to 6474. Any other similar agents out there or other TKIs that are kind of getting close to the clinic or you think maybe hold some promise?
Well, I think sorafenib and sunitinib are the two compounds that are most exciting with respect to lung cancer patients. There is a clinical trial that's ongoing with carboplatin taxol plus or minus sorafenib that we're looking forward to seeing the results. It's a large study. It's a registration trial.
When do you think that'll be complete or we'll have data from that?
I don't know. I know it's been ongoing at least for a few months, so it's probably going to require at least another year or so to complete accrual and to begin to analyze some of the data.
Can you talk a little bit about the issue of the predictors of response to EGFR TKIs in terms of smoking status, mutation, phenotypic characteristics, and sort of how you put that all together right now?
Well, certainly there's a lot of exciting information emerging on mutations and especially specific mutations. The patients who have mutations in exon 19 and 20 of the EGFR tyrosine kinase domain appear to be the subgroup of patients with the best chance of having a major radiographic response to an EGFR-targeted agent such as erlotinib. Data presented at ASCO this past year indicated that objective responses in patients with those mutations at a rate of around 70 to 80%, with median survivals in those patients of over a year treated with the EGFR-targeted agent alone. So that's very exciting. On the other hand, it's the minority of patients that have those types of specific EGFR mutations. If you look at the lung cancer patient population as a whole and realize that only 12% of them have any mutations, and that it's about half to two-thirds of those that have specific mutations at exon 19 or 20, we're talking about selecting out less than 10% of patients on the basis of mutations to be treated with these agents in some specific manner. There clearly are many other patients who can have major radiographic responses or clinical benefit from these drugs that mutations do not analyze. Now, some of them can be identified by FISH, by fluorescence in situ hybridization analysis of gene copy number, looking at overexpression and amplification. And that, at least in retrospective studies, appears to target and identify a larger proportion of patients. Upwards of 30 to 35% of patients will be so-called FISH positive when their cutoff criteria are overexpression amplification. And that identifies a large proportion of the patients who will have either objective response or some slowing of progression that results in some survival benefit. Again, there are still a few patients that will fall outside of the EGFR mutation and the FISH positive camp, although very few of them. One of the problems, I think, with fluorescence in situ hybridization is that it identifies many patients who are not going to benefit from these agents. So we still don't have a test that is highly specific and highly sensitive at the same time.
How about smoking status?
I think smoking status right now remains one of the best selectors at the bedside that you can use to enrich the population of patients that you select for treatment with an EGFR-targeted agent. In the first-line setting, somewhere around 12 to maybe 15% of patients in North America are never smokers. They smoke less than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime, smoke maybe back during college. Some of us think that that group can perhaps even be extended a bit to patients who were less than a pack per day cigarette smokers for less than 20 years and stopped smoking 15 or 20 years ago. I think what we're saying is that someone who has a limited history of cigarette smoking and stopped smoking 15 or 20 years ago and now presents with lung cancer has about a 50-50 chance that that cancer is still due to cigarette smoking or due to whatever other mechanism there is that has produced a lung cancer that now shares all of the response properties of cancers that occur in never smokers.
And what fraction would you estimate in the first line setting of people are oligosmokers in addition to the 10%, 12% non-smokers?
Yeah, it's probably about another 10% or so.
Obviously, there are trials specifically looking at enriched populations, but right now in a non-protocol setting, let's say in the adjuvant setting, do you think it's rational to discuss with a patient using erlotinib who's a never smoker or a known mutation?
I would not recommend that. I think there are some very good clinical trials that are in progress. They're widely available to physicians, even in the community setting, and I would strongly encourage them to participate in those clinical trials. We need an answer, and we want to know which patients should we give these expensive drugs to, drugs that have toxicity profiles that may be different from the toxicity profile of chemotherapy, but are still toxicity profiles that are intolerable to many patients. The current therapeutic goal, as you know, is what we call personalized medicine, trying to identify the subset of patients who are the most likely to benefit from therapies and to treat them in a more specific way. And I think that rather than giving medicines empirically to all patients, knowing that we're benefiting some, knowing that we're not only not benefiting others, but actually may harm others – that we really need to vigorously push in that direction. So I discourage everyone from just routinely giving an EGFR-targeted agent in the adjuvant setting to a never smoker without having the opportunity to objectively assess response, or more importantly, something that I've seen being done in the community rather widely, is after giving first-line chemotherapy to a patient with advanced stage 3B or 4 lung cancer, after completing four cycles, maybe five or six cycles of treatment, rather than coasting until there's evidence of disease progression, many physicians are simply giving erlotinib as maintenance therapy. There's no evidence to support that whatsoever, and I would discourage them from doing that. I would say wait until there's evidence of disease progression, and then make a decision at that point of what is in your patient's best interest.
Can you talk a little bit about what was presented at ASCO and what we know about the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib and where you think that's heading?
Well, the information that was presented was there were several studies. There were two major studies that were presented. The first study was a study conducted by Roy Herbst that simply looked at the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib in the second, and there may have been some patients in the third line setting. This was an unselected group of patients, and the objective response rate was close to 25%, so considerably higher than the 10% or so objective response rate one would expect with erlotinib alone. So that's quite encouraging and has led to a definitive randomized phase 3 trial in which I am participating in, and in fact, am one of the major accruers. It is the so-called BETA study, B-E-T-A, standing for bevacizumab and Tarceva, BETA study. So this is a randomized trial in the second-line setting in which all patients get Tarceva, get erlotinib, and then receive either placebo or bevacizumab every 3 weeks. So that study will answer the question as to whether or not there's some benefit to the combination. There was another pilot study also presented at ASCO by the group from MD Anderson in which they randomized patients, again, this was a randomized phase 2 trial, to receive chemotherapy combined with bevacizumab in the second-line setting. Physicians could select either docetaxel or pemetrexed, chemotherapy alone, or the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib. And again, the combination of bevacizumab with second-line chemotherapy also produced a favorable response rate and progression-free survival. So I think, you know, the data continues to accumulate regarding the important role of bevacizumab combined, I think, with any type of chemotherapy in patients with lung cancer. As long as you select them as patients without squamous cell cancer, who have no evidence of brain metastases on scanning. I personally prefer an MRI scan, but a CT scan with intravenous contrast is acceptable, and who are not on any anticoagulants for either deep venous thromboses or other conditions.
Do you think that it's acceptable to utilize the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab off study?
I do not. I think that now you're proposing using two very expensive drugs in the second-line setting with insufficient data to really support the use. And I think you still have to be concerned about safety issues. You know, if a patient would suffer a pulmonary hemorrhage under treatment with erlotinib and bevacizumab, that would put a community physician at risk because the database is just insufficient to support that combination. They're commercially available. It certainly is rational. I understand physicians want to do what's in their patient's best interest, but I think it's also very important that we're cognizant that the evidence for that combination is still very limited.
Any reason to think at this point, based on the data that's available, that the toxicity of the two agents combined is going to be any different than just what you would expect from the two individually?
No, none that I'm aware of.
What about, you mentioned, you know, how you select patients for bevacizumab, but one other criteria that was in the trial that I wonder how is getting played out in practice is performance status. How do you factor that in?
Yeah. Well, this was a trial, of course, where they selected patients with good performance status. But I think the basis for that selection was because all of these patients were going to receive chemotherapy. And in the first line setting, our belief is that platinum-based chemotherapy regimens, that the benefit is confined primarily to patients with performance status 0 and 1, although there is some evidence now that Corey Langers and others have shown that even in the performance status 2 patients, a carboplatin-based regimen is probably a little superior to a single agent.
Can you talk a little bit about the adjuvant trials that are going on right now, looking at bevacizumab and also looking at erlotinib?
Yeah. Well, there's a very important adjuvant trial with both of these agents. The erlotinib trial allows patients who have either received or not received adjuvant platinum-based chemotherapy to be randomized to receive either erlotinib or a placebo drug, although obviously the toxicity profile will expose who's receiving their erlotinib. And the treatment is for a 2-year period. But that's a very important landmark trial. It's hoped that we can gather tissue specimens from all of those patients, or at least from a high percentage of them, to increase our database of being able to identify who are the patients that have the major benefit. I understand that the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group is going to build on their landmark experience with bevacizumab in the patients in the stage 3B4 setting, and very shortly they'll be opening a trial for patients with, I believe, stage 1B, 2A, 2B, or completely resected 3A lung cancer to be treated with chemotherapy plus or minus bevacizumab. I'm not certain regarding the chemotherapy regimens, although I believe they are all cisplatin-based chemotherapy regimens, since we currently do not have evidence supporting the use of carboplatin-based regimens in the adjuvant setting.
And I guess that leads into the CALGB study, and I'd like to get your take on those data that were presented at ASCO.
Yeah, well, it certainly was disappointing to see those curves come together. Yeah, they remained separated, you know, through 2, 3, and 4 years, but came together at the 4th year and finally almost completely together at the 5th year, so that the difference in survival was no longer statistically significant.
And, of course, we're talking about the use of carbotaxol in stage 1B.
That's right. You know, that trial was closed a little early before its targeted accrual, because the monitoring committee identified a benefit in the survival outcome that seemed to warrant closing that study early. I'm not sure what to think of that study. It could be a problem with numbers, that maybe the study was just too small. It was less than 350 patients in that clinical trial. It could be a problem with stage. Stage 1B patients perform well, by and large. The proportion at risk of developing recurrence is obviously not as high as it is in stage 2A, 2B, 3A lung cancer.
What number would you give, incidentally, for overall for 1B?
Well, the recurrence rate is somewhere in the range of around 40 to 50%. Not more than half of the patients harbor micrometastatic disease. So unfortunately, we're treating everybody to try to benefit only half the patients. So any benefit that is gained in the one half of the patients is diluted by the fact that one half of the patients did not need treatment. So, you know, that further degrades some of the analysis of the outcome. And finally, it does raise the question as to whether or not carboplatin is as good as cisplatin when you're in the curative setting. I personally like carboplatin. I've always been a strong proponent of carboplatin. But now, with the lack of evidence supporting its use in the adjuvant setting, I'm using exclusively cisplatin.
So does that mean that prior to ASCO, you were using carbo and you switched?
Oh, yes. I was using carboplatin routinely for when I was in a non-protocol setting as my adjuvant chemotherapy regimen of choice. I was using it combined with Gemzar. My look at the data, looking at some 20 randomized trials, tells me that carboplatin Gemzar is probably as good as cisplatin Gemzar with respect to response and survival outcome in the stage 3B setting. Now, there, of course, have been meta-analyses that have looked at cis versus carbo in the stage 3B4 setting and have suggested that cisplatin may be a little bit better. Now, the majority of studies in those meta-analyses have been taxane studies. So at least I think there is the possibility that Gemzar may interact differently with platinum species and that there may not be the loss of efficacy that we see of carboplatin combined with a taxane when we substitute it for cisplatin combined with Gemzar. That's an open question, however, and remains to be answered.
So your usual current adjuvant regimen is what?
I use primarily cisplatin gemcitabine. I have also used cisplatin vinorelbine.
Can you talk a little bit about your approach to first-line therapy of metastatic disease?
Well, my approach, obviously, is first of all to favor clinical trials. I'm a strong believer in clinical trials. That's the only way we're going to move the field forward. Most of the clinical trials that are being conducted now are clinical trials that are looking at the addition of a novel targeted agent to standard chemotherapy. So patients are going to either receive the standard treatment or treatment of chemotherapy combined with a novel agent. So there's no loss to the patient, and these are important clinical trials, and we need the data. If for some reason it's not a clinical trial setting, if a clinical trial is not available, then my regimen of choice is combination carboplatin and gemcitabine. I use carboplatin at an AUC of 5 and gemcitabine at 1,000 per meter squared days 1 and 8 every 3 weeks. I believe it's among the most effective and best tolerated treatment regimens available for patients in the first line non-small cell lung cancer setting. Now, of course, if a patient meets all of the qualification criteria for use of bevacizumab, then I use bevacizumab combined with carboplatin paclitaxel or carboplatin taxotere. I've not yet used it in combination with carboplatin and Gemzar, and the reason for that is I'm awaiting the safety data that says that the thrombocytopenia that some patients experience with carboplatin and Gemzar-based regimens does not exacerbate the bleeding risks of bevacizumab. Theoretically, there should be no increased risk of pulmonary hemorrhaging or CNS hemorrhaging, but I do not want to do that until I see the data. A clinical trial has been completed in Europe of cisplatin gemcitabine with or without bevacizumab. I understand that a data safety monitoring committee that reviewed the first 200 or 300 patients did not see an increased risk of bleeding complications, so that trial was able to complete accrual to its target goal of about 900 patients. Accrual has been completed. We should be able to see data maybe within a year or so. But until that data becomes publicly available, personally, I've been reluctant to add bevacizumab to any Gemzar or carboplatin-based regimen that does not include a taxane.
How do you decide between docetaxel and paclitaxel in terms of combining it with carbo and bev?
Yeah. Well, in most cases, I've begun with paclitaxel. But what I've observed, perhaps anecdotally at the bedside, is a much higher rate of neurotoxicity. So I believe that bevacizumab may augment a number of chemotherapy toxicities. We know that it increases neutropenia, even increases slightly the rate of thrombocytopenia, although the difference is not statistically significant. But I believe that it may also have the potential to increase the neurotoxicity, although that difference did not emerge in the ECOG trial. So what I've been forced to do in some patients who develop severe neurotoxicity in the first or the second cycle of therapy is to substitute taxotere for Taxol.
Where do you think things are heading in terms of nab-paclitaxel and non-small cell?
Well, it's an interesting compound. I think that in lung cancer, the results of the clinical trial were a bit disappointing. I always thought that they should have used that agent at a higher dose to try to increase the response rate or survival outcome. I'd be very interested in seeing nab-paclitaxel combined with bevacizumab, because at least theoretically, there might be yet better drug delivery to the tumor bed. But I'm not sure what the future of that drug is in non-small cell lung cancer. I think the data with Xiotax was very interesting, in that here again was an agent that did not appear to be superior to paclitaxel when combined with carboplatin or superior to taxanes in the second-line setting non-small cell lung cancer patients, except in women. And going back to the laboratory, there now appears to be a biological basis for why women may have a more favorable response to Xiotax than men. And it has to do with estrogen-induced cathepsin, and how it metabolizes Xiotax, may increase intracellular distribution in the tumor cell, may change the pharmacokinetics of the drug a bit, that women may have a more favorable response.
One final question. What's your usual chemo radiation regimen for stage 3B?
Well, I've not been consistent in that. I've used a little bit of a number of regimens. At the present time, I favor carboplatin paclitaxel. I think there's a large database supporting the use of that combination. I had been a strong proponent of a platinum etoposide combined with radiation therapy followed by docetaxel. I've been a little disappointed in some of the problems with toxicity and overall outcomes with that regimen, so I think that I've defaulted to carboplatin paclitaxel.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.